Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the case before the state's highest court. Can a judge dismiss a juror who thinks the criminal justice system is racially biased?
I think that the judge took the point of view that anybody who thinks that the system is rigged cannot, regardless of what they say, be fair.
Also, President Trump claims victory on a new trade deal.
Throughout the campaign, I promised to renegotiate NAFTA, and today we have kept that promise.
We'll look at what's in the new agreement. And having conversations with young people about the sexual assault allegations against Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
We just need to talk to our young people. We need to give them more opportunities to wrestle with some of the complicated ideas of consent and communication.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. If you think the criminal justice system is biased, should you be barred from sitting on a jury? That was the thrust of a question before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court today in the case of a juror who was dismissed after saying that she believes the criminal justice system is rigged against African-American males. Joining us on the line to talk about this is Judge Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. She's also WBUR's legal analyst, and she wrote an amicus brief in this case. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
So let's give a little bit of background here. After searching an apartment in Brockton, police found cocaine, and they charged Quentin Williams, an African-American man, with possession with intent to distribute. Now, during jury selection for Williams' trial, a prospective juror was asked if she might have bias. And she said yes, because she worked with low-income youth, including teenagers convicted of drug crimes. And she also said she does think that the criminal justice system is unfair to young black males. The prosecutor asked that she be excused. The judge dismissed her for cause. So what's wrong with that?
Well, think about it this way. If she had said, for example, that I believe that the criminal justice system is always fair and that the outcome is always correct, we would not have recused her, even though that's not true. We would not have disqualified her, even though that's not true. And so, to some degree, this is a statement that is a general statement, which actually is also true. That is to say that the criminal justice system is unfair to African-American young men. The problem was there was another question that the judge should have asked, which is, having that in mind, having that in your view, would you be able to be fair in this case? In other words, one can have a general view of the criminal justice system, but nevertheless say, this is what I would do in a particular case. We do that in the death penalty setting all the time. What's your opinion about the death penalty? Well, I am generally opposed. Well, do you think that you could impose it if the facts require it? Yes. That second question is the bias question, because that is saying this set of ideas would be an impediment to my being fair in this case. But general views about the criminal justice system on either side should be in a different category.
So what basically would you say are the guidelines for determining potential bias in a potential juror or the fitness of a juror? I mean, it can, you know, people can have all kinds of opinions, and I would assume that you would want a variety of opinions among a jury pool. So what do you, as a judge, what guides you to make these decisions about juror fitness?
Well, the issue was, everybody has opinions, right? You don't have a jury. That's why you want them. You want lay opinions and you want diverse opinions on a jury. So the issue is, are the opinions that you hold, will that be an impediment to your evaluating the evidence in this case? In other words, are you going to say, I therefore will never convict? Or are you say, I therefore will always convict? Or with respect to the death penalty, I will always impose it or I will never impose it. So the issue is whether these ideas are an impediment to your looking at the Commonwealth's case and the individual individually. And so this general statement shouldn't have qualified.
Now, the prosecution said that this juror gave contradictory answers, right? Saying she did think that she could put aside her bias, but also saying, or she did not think that she could put aside her bias, but then saying that, yes, she could be impartial. I mean, what's wrong with saying, you know what, we want a juror to not equivocate here. We want a juror to be able to say clearly, I have this opinion, but in this case, that would not affect the outcome of my decision as a juror.
That is a great question. The only problem is that it only works in one direction, which is that if she said, you know, I think the drug laws are fabulous and should be rigorously enforced, and then said in the second sentence, you know, but I can be fair, the odds are she would be on the jury. So this is someone who did the opposite, who said, I have these concerns about the criminal justice system, but I can be fair. Frankly, and now she's off. Frankly, the I can be fair statement, in 9 times out of 10, judges will use as sufficient to get someone on the jury. You use the juror's own view of whether or not they can be fair, particularly, I might add, a juror who has been honest, as this one has. Usually, as I said, the question, do you think you can set aside those views about the pretrial publicity, about, you know, your view about the criminal justice system in general, do you think you can set them aside and be fair in this particular case? 9 times out of 10, we accept that. And so it should give one pause that it wasn't accepted in this case.
How do you think that the ruling in this case is going to affect jury selection going forward?
Well, I mean, I think that it really enables, I would hope that it would enable a more searching questioning of jurors. In other words, the intonation about, you know, I like the criminal justice system, I don't, that should never be enough on either side. The problem is that we have in Massachusetts and on the federal side in particular, we have a very perfunctory voir dire. So, you know, the it seems to me that this case raises questions of how far the questioning should go, how much more nuanced the questioning should be. Otherwise, we are just, you know, accepting general state here, disqualifying someone because of general statements, or, as I said, oftentimes, most times, qualifying them because of their own view of whether they can be fair. I'd love to see a more searching voir dire, more searching questioning.
Let's switch gears here because we can't let you go without talking about the Senate confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominees.
What Senate confirmation hearings? I know.
Did you hear about that little story that's like taking
right.
It's grabbing all the headlines for forever, right. It seems. You wrote an op-ed about this in the Boston Globe, and as a federal judge, I'm just curious, your initial thoughts, initial headline of your own about these Kavanaugh hearings.
Well, what I wrote was that I actually heard the Kavanaugh statement, rather, as opposed to seeing him initially on television, and I told the cab driver, I was in a cab, and I told him to change the station, that he wasn't on the confirmation hearing at all, but that I thought that he was, we were listening to a talk show host. The affect of the judge, the things he said, the way he said it, the attacks mentioning, you know, Democrats, the Clintons, and left-wing sources of funds were extraordinary to me, and that alone, it seemed to me to be disqualifying, because the standard for a judge is not just are you actually biased, right? But the standard is, do you convey the appearance of impartiality? Is there something you're doing or saying that reasonable people might consider to be partial? And it seems to me these statements certainly raise the question about anyone would reasonably believe he would be impartial in cases involving A, Democrats, B, the Clintons, C, right, left-wing groups. And it seems to me that raises a serious question.
But, you know, I think his supporters, just to play devil's advocate here, I think his supporters would say, you know, Judge Kavanaugh is really angry. His reputation is destroyed. Let's face it. His reputation is destroyed regardless of whether he gets on the Supreme Court right now. So this will always be part of Brett Kavanaugh's history. His youthful drinking will always be out there for people to examine. He's really been made kind of a laughingstock. So, I mean, he's angry. Is that so bad? I guess.
Well, I think that if he had said that this process is punishing, that my reputation has been destroyed, that we should think about better ways of selecting judges that don't require these kinds of costs, that would have been different. But that's not what he said. He attacked the Democrats, the Clintons, left-wingers. Yes, you could certainly talk about that. That is true. That is a true conversation we should have. But he went much further than that, you know, and some might say sort of exposing the partisan, the deep partisan. The fact that he was able to say that and thought that that was appropriate to say gives me pause. And should give everyone pause.
Some folks say, though, that this is too much focus on his temperament, and there's not really been any focus on his judicial record, which might be more relevant because this was sort of like a job interview for how he will be as a justice.
Well, there was a focus on his judicial record up until now, but the judicial record was basically endorsed by the Senate. In other words, the judicial record, which had been the focus before, which is a record which is, in my view, just analogous to Judge Bork's record. Bork, as you know, was famously rejected right. many years ago. In my view, Judge Kavanaugh is almost as far outside of the judicial mainstream as is as was Judge Bork. Now, we're not talking about that because the Senate was poised to confirm him even on those facts. Likewise, there's not a lot of discussion about whether he was dissembling in his comments to the committee, again, because we got past that. So if this conversation has supplanted that, it's really only because the Senate was poised to confirm him, notwithstanding issues about his record and notwithstanding issues about his representations before the committee.
And just very briefly, what do you think all of this, the spectacle of all of this and the way that the conversations have gone, what does this do to the judiciary in general?
Well, I think, I mean, it pains me to think about what this does. The judiciary in general is one thing, but particularly for the Supreme Court. I mean, I would imagine if we were a fly on the wall of the Supreme Court now, they would all be tremendously discomfited by this, and particularly if he is confirmed, right? Imagine that. Friday he's confirmed, Monday he takes the oath of office, and on Tuesday, you know, and on Monday he starts hearing a Democratic challenge to Republican gerrymandering. How uncomfortable will we all feel when that decision comes out 5-4 and he's the fifth vote? Will we feel like justice has been done? That's the Supreme Court that concerns me more than anything.
All right. Judge Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. President Trump is declaring victory on the trade front.
It's my great honor to announce that we have successfully completed negotiations on a brand new deal to terminate and replace NAFTA and the NAFTA trade agreements with an incredible new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement called USMCA. It sort of just works. MCA.
So, what's in this new deal, and what will it mean for American workers and companies? Well, joining us to talk about this is the Boston Globe's Quick Study columnist, Evan Horowitz. Evan, welcome back.
Thanks, Deborah. Happy fundraising season.
Oh, thank you. Well, first, let's not talk about fundraising. Let's talk about NAFTA. So, well, you call this NAFTA 2.0. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I guess we should start with what the heck to call it. I mean, is it NAFTA 2.0? Is it the USMCA? I've heard the nice riffs on, like, the Village People, the USMCA, a it really seems like we should keep calling it NAFTA because it's mostly NAFTA. The changes are slight, non-trivial, but slight, and the basic framework remains in place: low tariffs among the three nations of North America.
So let's talk about some of the changes, even if they are slight. The biggies are dairy, auto. What are the biggies in your mind?
Yeah. So, well, it depends what you mean by biggie.
Okay.
But yes, the goals that the Trump administration was able to accomplish include some increased access to the Canadian dairy market. Canada has traditionally made it very difficult for other countries to export dairy and agriculture. And now some dairy farmers will be able to export a little more cheese, a little more milk, a little more sort of dry milk powder that's easier to transport. So that's a slight gain. We're talking about fractions of a percentage point in trade for a teeny number of jobs, but it's something the administration really cared about, and they got it. And the next thing is some new incentives to make sure auto manufacturers build their cars in the U.S. instead of in low-wage factories in Mexico.
So is this good for Canada, then?
Is it good for Canada? I mean, again, the big picture is it doesn't change all that much. Canadian dairy farmers are not happy, but it's not going to affect them in a significant way. And the Canadians got something in exchange for that, which is the ability to continue either exporting or dumping, depending on your perspective, softwood lumber. This has been an ongoing American complaint about Canada. They subsidize their lumber industry, and then the excess ends up back in the United States, underpriced, and it hurts loggers and lumber industry in the U.S. And the Trump administration, along with previous administrations, tried to end pieces of NAFTA that made this possible, and they didn't. So the Canadians get to keep subsidizing and exporting lumber. They have to give up a little bit of, accept a little bit more in the way of dairy imports.
What about this independent tariff dispute settlement system that was involved here?
So that's, okay, so there are two things to think about here. One is the kind of lumber problem. That is, can the nations contest each other when they dump? And the answer is, it's very hard to do, and it's still very hard to do. The other is the investor state settlement process. That's like companies who are really unhappy about some new law in Mexico or in Canada. There was a system where they had their own special courts where they could go and contest these laws that are passed by parliaments, and they could win rulings from courts, special courts outside of the normal court system. This has gotten increasingly controversial. In other places, for instance, you've had cigarette companies that will sue nations for anti-smoking campaigns in these special courts. And so they've gotten really unpopular. And that mostly went away. There's still one exception, which is if you're an oil and gas company and Mexico decides to nationalize their gas industry, you'll still be allowed to complain. But apart from that, no, that's gone. And that actually could be a big deal. It's something that the business lobby in the United States cared about. They may continue to lobby against the new NAFTA. We'll see.
So this is a victory for the White House.
I think, if nothing else, it shows that – I think it counts as the first real evidence that Trump's scorched earth or sort of mercurial foreign policy negotiating strategy can pay off. He has taken – well, he's levied tariffs against Canada and Mexico. He threatened to throw out the agreement. He threatened further tariffs. He then split the negotiation, refused to negotiate with both at the same time, took a kind of divide and conquer strategy. This generated a lot of resentment, but then it ended in an agreement. And I think until now it's been hard to point to any examples and say, yes, Trump's negotiating posture, aggressive as it is, can work. But now he can. He can say, yes, we got this agreement. I think that's a big deal. I think that's a big deal for the agreement, and in some ways just reinforces his tendency to act in a kind of belligerent ways with other countries.
Now, this went through Sunday, this deal, and it was sort of frenetic. This was a deadline, right? Why was
Sunday
the deadline?
It wasn't a deadline. You know, it's like it was a self-imposed deadline. And the reason it was self-imposed is because, there are elections coming up in Mexico. And we really want to get the new deal signed before the new government comes in Mexico because they may not like it. So this is a very strange part of this whole thing is you've got a new president who's already been elected in Mexico but hasn't taken office, takes office in December, and they're trying to rush this through before he can take office in fear that he may oppose it. So there's a kind of – it's not anti-democratic – it's not outright anti-democratic, but they're sort of playing against democratic systems in other countries to move this faster. That's the only reason we had this deadline.
But this deal still needs to be approved.
It needs to be approved by all three countries.
Right.
That's easier in Canada and Mexico. We have parliamentary systems. It's harder in the U.S., though. There won't be a vote until January. That's because these kinds of deals have long vetting requirements. Congress is going to take its time. It's going to look at it. It has to by law. So they may not vote until after the midterms and after the new Congress comes to D.C. in January, which means you could see Democrats in control of the House getting a vote on this deal. I still think they'll vote for it, but it'll be an interesting test. And I mean, I just lay out why. She nodded at me, which means I can go on for listeners who can't see. So basically, the challenge will be if the Democrats take control of the House, it will be on a wave of anti-Trump sentiment, right? So they will come in, and it will be very hard for them to vote for a Trump trade deal like USMCA or NAFTA or whatever we're calling it. On the other hand, this trade deal is not a big deal. There aren't big reasons to oppose it. And the few changes that do exist align with some democratic priorities, like there are better protections for workers in Mexico. That's something that Democrats support. Why would they vote against a trade bill that includes that?
Okay, well, it'll be interesting. Evan Horowitz, quick study columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. With deep divisions over the sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, we want to spend some time today talking about how young people are processing this controversy and this cultural moment. A Quinnipiac University poll released yesterday says 48% of American voters most believe Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, 41% most believe Brett Kavanaugh. And today, President Trump said this.
It's a very scary time for young men in America when you can be guilty of something that you may not be guilty of.
So how does this divide affect teenagers, particularly when it comes to talking with them about sexual assault and consent? Joining us in studio is Megha Rebell. She's founder and director of Partners in Sex Education, an organization that delivers comprehensive sex education to schools across Massachusetts. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Have you talked with your children about these hearings? And what do you tell them? What do you tell teenagers about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings and the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings and the related controversy that's been going on since the hearings ended? What does education around sex and consent look like in your school? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Megha, what have you been hearing from educators and young people amid all of this debate about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings?
So our organization, Partners in Sex Education, has always taught about consent. That's an integral part of teaching about healthy relationships and communication and sort of getting the basis of how young people should learn to relate to each other. And certainly consent questions have been coming up in classes. Our educators are not trying to get into political debates with the students, but I have been hearing even as recently as today from an educator that they were talking about it. And a lot of the conversation tended to be polarized by gender, which is unfortunate because I feel like we should be getting the same messages.
So give me an example of what was happening in terms of that polarization.
Well, I think that young men are not always understanding. I think young men are often told, and for instance by the president in that quote, they're told that they're the ones that are somehow victimized by this. Mm-hmm. And I think to even polarize it along gender lines is a mistake. I think that we all need to think about how to do better in terms of how to communicate and how to respect other people's personhood and how to have sexuality in a caring relationship and not just make it down to the letter of the law in terms of consent.
So is there something specific that you say? Is there sort of a general rule of thumb that you tell young people about understanding what consent looks like?
Well, that's a great question, because the way young people often want to approach it is, like I said, often to the letter of the law. And so there are things about the law that they need to know. They need to know that the legal age of consent in Massachusetts is 16. They need to know that if somebody is under the influence of drugs or alcohol, they cannot legally consent. And so these are, and there's many other aspects. So these are important. But I think that when you're talking about, sometimes you're talking about just what is criminally prosecutable and what is not. Mm-hmm. And that should not be the standard that we hold. And that should not be what we're teaching. We should be teaching people how to be respectful. And so consent education needs to be broader than that. And it needs to be not just about sex. Consent education is about everything. And it can be taught from a very, very young age.
Mm-hmm. And how? How do you do that at a young age?
Well, for instance, when anyone, we talk about this in elementary schools all the time in terms of somebody's physical space and somebody's boundaries. And does somebody else want to be touched or not? Is that okay? Keeping your hands to yourself.
Right.
Whether children are, allowed to say yes and no to things that happen to them. And I think at a very, very young age, this should happen in the home, right? So a child says no to being tickled. And what do we do? Often adults, because it's fun to make children laugh, will continue to tickle a child. But what have we taught them about their capacity to say no to that which happens to their bodies? And so I think that if we respect that no, and then we're teaching them that their no will be respected, and we're teaching them from the youngest age that they can also have that same kind of respect for other people's no.
I want to talk a little bit about the women as well. We mentioned boys a little bit, but and just in case someone hasn't heard some of the testimony, we're going to play some of the emotional piece of what Christine Blasey Ford said last week during the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here's a bit of that.
I believed he was going to rape me. I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life. It was hard for me to breathe, and I thought that Brett was accidentally going to kill me.
So, Megan Rebell, when that type of testimony is televised and replayed over and over again, how should parents and teachers deal with that?
Wow, yeah, that is really emotional. And I think that the problem there, first I want to say that the problem there in that situation is not, as we often assume, a miscommunication or a misunderstanding about whether or not she gave consent. Clearly, she did not, right? That is a basic ignoring of her personhood. And her, that was, to make a point to other men. It was a man kind of showing off in a way for another man. And so that is a whole different situation. But those are also the kinds of things that with a social-emotional learning curriculum that we can address in the classroom. So what should parents tell their young people?
I guess and tell young women.
And tell young women. And I guess the idea that you should be respected, that you have a right to say yes or no with what happens to your body, and that I feel like if young women believed that they should be respected and that they should be heard, then they would be more able to communicate, but also more able to report when something goes wrong, because there are actually very, very low numbers of young women and young men, because let's not forget that young men are also assaulted at a really unfortunately high rate. So there'd be less young women and young men who feel that it is their fault and who feel that they will not be believed. And unfortunately, these messages that are happening on the national stage are reinforcing the idea that it is their fault and that they should not be believed. And we need to fight very hard to prevent that.
Let's take some callers now. James is calling from Manchester by the Sea. James, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I'm good. I just had a quick question for Megan. I know that, I believe that everybody should be heard, and if there's an allegation, you have to dig into that and dig deep. But one of the repercussions I'm seeing is my son's in high school, and girls may come up to him and start talking to him and start showing interest in him, and he's kind of shying away because he's become a little bit nervous about what they might say if he advances or encourages that forward thinking. So I was just wondering, how do you talk to your children about that, and what would be the best way to approach that? Because I don't want him to go, oh, my God, I don't want to talk to him, but I also don't want him to cross a line to get him in trouble later on in life.
Well, thank you, James, for asking that question. I love that you asked that. I do talk to a lot of parents, particularly parents of high school students, particularly parents of seniors. I am the parent of an 18-year-old son. And I do talk to a lot of parents who are concerned about things like that, things about false accusations or crossing lines that they didn't know were there. And I would say that treating people with respect and listening to them and, respecting their ability to consent is something that we can talk to all of our young people about, of any gender, and that I wouldn't be concerned about false accusations. What I would be concerned about is people crossing lines that they may not have meant to cross. So it's about respecting lines, because we say that consent is simple, but it's actually not. It's really complicated. So respect for others. And I would also be concerned with any assaults that any of our young men will themselves face. So I think it's great that you're thinking about what's best for him. And I hope that you can talk to him about how to have a healthy relationship and how to communicate. But, they're not always healthy. And so how to sort of look out for him and back away from things that seem like they're threatening to him.
Right. Another caller, Helene, is calling from Framingham. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I'd like to say I'm very proud of Massachusetts for having a good comprehensive curriculum for this. I think all states should, but I feel particularly fortunate living in Massachusetts. I wanted to maybe put out a enthusiastic consent as some language, because sometimes somebody asks and they said no, and then they keep asking, and for whatever reason, either feeling worn down or pressured, it doesn't seem like enthusiastic consent. And how I've spoken to my son is to say that nobody should be doing anything that they would feel regretful, embarrassed, humiliated, or ashamed of the next day, including him. And I think there's a way to have people understand that not only somebody saying yes, because, again, it's not like going to a movie, but if you tell your friend, let's go to this movie, well, I don't know if I'm going to like it. Oh, come on, let's give it a try. It's not the same kind of thing. So getting enthusiastic consent, like, yes, this is something they're both ready for, they're both interested in, they're both willing to do or try, is, I think, making it a little more clear to not cross those lines that people, well, she said okay. And
all right. Oh, are those good guidelines,
Sagara?
So,
thank you, Helene. That was an amazingly articulate explanation of enthusiastic consent. I particularly like your description of how somebody feels about it later, that somebody should not be doing things that they're ashamed of. And all of those other things. So I love that description. I do want to address the idea that we have comprehensive curriculum in Massachusetts. I would love to know what community you're in, and because it sounds like it does a great job with comprehensive sexuality education. However, Massachusetts as a whole is very inconsistent, because Massachusetts does not have any required curriculum. It is one of about half of the states in the nation that requires no kind of sexual health curriculum, doesn't require anything at all. Only 8 states in the nation require consent curriculum, and Massachusetts is certainly not one of them. And I just wanted to say that we tried to pass last year the Healthy Youth Act. And the Healthy Youth Act would have required not that schools had sex ed, but that if they had sex ed, it'd be medically accurate, age appropriate, and inclusive. And so that means mapped to the national sex ed standards. It has to be true, and it has to be gender and orientation inclusive. It does sound as if you may have that in your community, so I think that's excellent. But I hope that we can get all the communities to catch up in Massachusetts.
And so right now, then, in the schools that you work in, I mean, are there wide differences among schools in terms of what students are taught?
So Partners in Sex Education goes to a wide variety of schools, including some public schools and charter schools, although the bulk of the schools that we go to are independent schools. Public schools are very inconsistent in whether they have sex education, and this is largely based on whether they have a health teacher who is committed to sex education and who can do consent education and all of these things. I strongly recommend having a health teacher because that is the person who is the most well-versed in social-emotional learning.
Okay, well, maybe that's the topic of our next show. Megan Rebell, founder and director of Partners in Sex Education, an organization that delivers sex education in schools across the state. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.